Podcasts of Homegrown are made possible thanks to support from listeners like you. Consider becoming a member of WFPL by calling 502-814-6565 or at the website wfpl.org. Thanks.
Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishing.
Looking at the moon.
Looking at the moon.
And garden supplies.
Garden supplies. Two things that will help you figure out how to plant your garden and grow your garden and harvest your garden.
There is a connection there.
There is a connection there.
Moon, planting by the light of the moon and
absolutely
having the right stuff to plant with.
And we're actually going to find out what the story behind that story, in fact, you know, what kind of role does the moon actually play for our gardening activities down here on Earth. But Don Spain is going to be in the studio with us today. He's the vice president of the Louisville Astronomical Society, and he's been following the moon for, 50-some-odd years.
Yeah, very interesting man, and he knows his stuff and tells a lot of great stories about it. And looking forward to having him, along with a visit to the new natural farm and garden supply company in downtown Louisville.
Yep. There's a new company called Fresh Start Grower Supply. Steve Paradis started it. And basically, they've got all natural and organic stuff for the farm and the garden. So, you know, whether you have livestock, you know, the chickens, whether it's beef, sheep, the whole sort of gamut of livestock you could raise. But then also just garden supplies. So if you're looking for certain organic products, and I remember, you know, people had been asking us where we could find locally the red wigglers.
Yep.
Which are the ideal composting worms.
The worms, yeah.
You can get them there, you know. So the more we can shop locally, in my mind, the better. And now we have this Fresh Start Grower Supply that will, you know, cater to the needs of the gardeners that want to get away from conventional types of fertilizers, pesticides, that sort of thing. So we're going to go check it out and see what they do indeed have to offer.
Yeah, I'd rather wiggle on a compost pile than on a hook.
No kidding.
It's a happier life for the red wigglers.
Yep, in downtown Louisville to boot. All right, so that's coming up today on the show. Bob, what's going on in your garden?
I'm still keeping score with the wet weather, and it's catching up to me. One, my cool weather also. The crepe myrtles haven't bloomed at all. I don't know about
really?
You.
Really? Ours did great.
Might have been real late to non-existent, so I don't know if it's the weather-related or cool-related or what. And my heptacodium is one of my favorite trees. Usually this time of year, they're covered in kind of pink blossoms, whiten and turn pink.
And yours didn't either?
Oh, well, some have really well, but others have got this black-looking blight on them on the leaves, which heptacodiums are prone to anyway.
Yeah.
So I'm blaming the weather. It can't be me. Mm-hmm. So I'm blaming the weather for both those things. How about the Wishy State? What's up?
Our crepe myrtles did just fine this year, sorry about that.
Yeah.
Chinese chestnuts are in, and I was going to roast some before this morning, before coming in, so I could share some with you, but I just simply ran out of time.
Okay.
But I'm going to probably do some roasting and try to figure out how to process them as well, because you can, like, soak them in brandy or something like that. You can freeze them too, but I'll be bringing some Chinese chestnuts in. So here's the interesting thing. You know, we talked about figs earlier. These are all my crops that, you know, no apples. They were all diseased because of the rain. Exactly. So at least I've got the chestnuts. I've got persimmons, that sort of thing. And then I always look forward to the figs. All of our figs are loaded, Bob. And Andy said, because we were doing some garden cleanup the other day, he looked at me and he said, you know, we're not going to get any figs this year, are we? I'm like, no. They're loaded, but they're just not going to ripen in time. And therein lies the problem with figs in cooler climates. And if we have a hot, dry summer, the rest of the garden's not going to be really happy, but the figs are going to be happy. But this year, it's just been too cool and too wet, and they're not going to ripen.
Yeah, mine's the same way.
It's sad. Right. Because, literally, we've got three really, really healthy fig shrubs, basically, here, loaded, and we're not going to get a thing.
Now, will you go buy some?
No.
Will you sell out? You won't
go
to...
No, I don't do that. You know me. I eat squash all summer long. You got to eat what you got. You can't go and buy it if you got persimmons on the tree.
I hear you.
So, yeah, that's the reality. Chinese chestnuts are reliable, shall I say, but the figs are not, unfortunately.
Okay.
So, oh, well. But there's a couple things going on the calendar. Yeah, out at Hidden Hill, in fact.
Yeah. This is going to sound maybe too noble, but when Janet and I started Hidden Hill 9 years ago now, one of the things I wanted to do was host events, really interesting events, to a broad section of people. And on October 17th from 1 to 4 p.m., the Crane House in Louisville, which is an Asian culture house, we're going to have a chrysanthemum festival.
Oh, great.
It's going to be fun. Yeah, we're going to have food and art and some Tai Chi and some dancing, a lot of stuff for the kids. Mm-hmm. I got koi fish out there. So 1 to 4 on the 17th at Hidden Hill will be a just Asian culture, Korean, mm-hmm. Chinese, Japanese, everything. It's really going to be fun. And that night, the Louisville Astronomical Society is going to come out.
There you go.
We're going to set up in the field, mm-hmm. and anybody can come out and look at the stars.
Wow. That's a great
idea.
We've
done that 3 or 4 times, they are great.
Cool.
Great people.
Sounds like a fun day.
It's our last weekend. We're closing the 17th or 18th, so we're excited about this.
Cool. Sounds good. All right. And speaking of the Louisville Astronomical Society, Bob.
Yeah, we've got with us today in the studio Don Spain, Vice President of the Louisville Astronomical Society, a lifelong moon enthusiast and author of a book, The 6-Inch Lunar Atlas, which we'll talk about a little later. But mostly we want to say, Don, welcome to Homegrown.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
Where'd your interest in the moon begin?
It began 1956.
Okay.
I'd actually gotten a little bitty spotting telescope for Christmas. Uh-huh. And the first object I looked at with it was the moon, and just fell in love with it immediately.
Yeah.
The moon got some good press recently with the discovery of some traces of water on the surface, but let's talk about the moon itself first. What is it, and how did it get there?
Well, there's actually 16 large moons in the solar system that's bigger than 600 miles in diameter. Our moon is the fifth largest.
Okay.
And the moon is a terrestrial rocky body, similar to Mercury and actually the Earth. It's composed of basaltic lava, various metal oxides, and a wide assortment of other minerals. Mm-hmm. Its diameter is about 2,160 miles, which is about one-fourth that of the Earth. Its average distance from the Earth is about 238,000 miles. This can vary by as much as 26,000 miles because the orbit is not circular. Some full moons occasionally will look bigger than other full moons because the moon is closer to the Earth, and that difference can be as much as 11%.
So it literally is closer to, during certain times of the year. Because what always amazes me in terms of size, when the moon first comes up, not every moon, mm-hmm. but when the moon first comes up, I want to say like last month,
right,
was humongous, and as it gets higher in the horizon, it gets a little smaller. But when it first makes it above the horizon, glowing brightly, and it was just humongous.
It's actually an optical illusion of sorts. Actually, when the moon is rising, it's a little bit farther away than when it's directly overhead.
Mm-hmm.
But when you see it coming above the horizon, you got other objects to compare it with,
okay,
which makes it looks bigger.
Huh.
And as it gets higher, there's nothing to compare it with.
Huh.
And even though it is up to 1% closer, it looks farther away.
Hmm.
And actually, where you have no thing to compare it with, like you're out at sea and the moon's rising, it actually still looks bigger because you do have a horizon to see it against.
Okay, I see.
Now, how long has it been up there, and how did it get trapped in Earth's orbit?
The moon is about 4.5 billion years old. The current theory, it was formed when a big asteroid about the size of Mars smashed into the Earth back then.
Wow.
And a lot of material got thrown off and went into orbit around the Earth, kind of like Saturn's rings, and they all eventually got together and just made the moon.
Huh. So is that how all moons are assumed created?
Well, when you get out to the big planets like Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune,
mm-hmm.
The bigger ones probably were formed that way. The smaller ones were probably captured asteroids or other objects just wandered around, and the gravitational pull of those planets just pulled them into it.
So by definition, what is a moon then? Just something that's stuck in your orbit?
Right. Well, that's a good way to put it. Yeah, they actually got trapped. They circled around, and they're in a defined orbit around the planet, mm-hmm. and they just circle around, and they're there all the time.
Okay.
But the moon is dead still. It doesn't rotate at all?
It actually rotates once every 28 days. It's locked into a tidal lock with the Earth.
Yeah.
So we see one side of it. But as it goes around, if you were on the sun looking at it, you would see every bit of the moon as it makes that 28-day rotation.
Okay.
But since we're on the inside of that orbit, we only see the one side.
Huh. Well, let's kind of move back then to man and the moon going way back to the ancient times. I'm sure they looked up in the sky, and this thing appeared up there in different phases and different colors. What were they thinking?
Well, the prehistory would observe the moon, and most of them, even up to historical times, would assign a god to it. because it was ever-changing, and it was on a regular basis. So that was actually the calendar that we now know it. It's a lunar calendar. Actually, the word month is a derivation of moon.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. So every 28th and fraction days, it'll come back to that, so you can have a calendar throughout the year.
Mm-hmm. Now, the predictability of it all.
Exactly. And after a while, you notice when they would notice weeds and other wild crops would start growing at certain full moons during the year or new moons. So, mm-hmm. so when the spring moon comes on and as agriculture come along, they knew that was time to start their planting.
Mm-hmm. We did an interview a couple of weeks ago, the brother gardeners, and they were talking about in the early 18th century, most all of horticulture was based on much of that kind of lunar model and like planting. You know, if you grafted something during a full moon, then you'd be met with success in a way that you wouldn't be, and it wasn't until, mid to later 18th century that they started to use science. So clearly the moon had a lot of power, I guess what we could call a little bit of folklore in terms of the natural world. Is there any indication that there may be some truth to it? You know what I mean? In terms of gravitational pull, in terms of even just light at night.
Well, both of those have a bearing on it. Mm-hmm. The moon is the principal cause of tides on the Earth. And they pull the tides up out of the oceans. They actually pull up part of the land mass when they're passing over. That'll come up to an inch or two. It'll actually pull the land mass itself up.
Huh.
And since most biological life is composed 78% of water, the current theory is that when the moon is in the right position, a full moon or even a new moon,
uh-huh.
it'll actually pull the juices up out of the plant, the sap up into the trees as they come out of dormancy.
Uh-huh.
That will help them grow. Huh. And the oldest saying was that you wanted to plant crops that grow above ground from new moon to full moon.
Mm-hmm.
Plants below the ground, like potatoes, carrots, and whatever, you would plant from full moon to new moon.
Huh.
Well,
so there's your science, people.
Exactly.
All right.
Well, looking back over history, are there any particularly interesting rituals that came along with the moon? Do people dress up in yellow costumes and dance around circles and stuff?
No, Bob, you're the only one that does that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's a Hoosier thing.
Busted. Sorry, go ahead.
There was occasional festivals and whatever. And probably the most famous one is the ones around Halloween.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of cultures didn't have any set time for that. And when you get into the medieval time with the witchcraft and whatever, and how the witches were associated with certain full moons,
mm-hmm.
the time of the year would have their coven meetings. That would depend on the local covens. They normally didn't have any set time, but they would actually go out and dance out in the forest under the moonlight.
Well, in fact, if you just look at it for practical reasons, it makes perfect sense because it's brighter outside. Do you know what I mean? You wouldn't want to do it in pitch darkness, but do it while the moon's bright because you've got your natural light.
Well,
nothing clandestine necessarily.
Well, that's true. It's like the harvest moon, mm-hmm. and it's time to harvest the products, and especially in the before all the mechanization of on the farms when you had to do it with horse and hand or whatever,
mm-hmm.
and you had a big crops, you needed as much light as you could when it come there, and the full moon shining out there, you could work well into the night when that harvest moon is up there.
Thus the harvest moon, huh?
Right.
Absolutely.
It's as much common sense as moon work.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Yeah. So you mentioned the harvest moon. There are other moons that are associated with certain events as well. You've got a shirt on that says the snow moon. Can you talk about some of the different moons throughout the month, or throughout the year, rather?
Okay, there's several. Most of them are associated with Native Americans.
Mm-hmm.
The shirt I have on has snow moon. That's actually the February full moon. And actually, I'm part Cherokee. I know it doesn't look like it. And I talked to my mother about it. My great-grandmother was a full-blooded Cherokee.
Mm-hmm.
She was of the Wolf Clan. And my mom said, you were born on February 23rd,
uh-huh.
There was snow on the ground and under a full moon.
All right.
So I pulled this up on the internet, and she's exactly right. At 2 uh-huh. o'clock, the 23rd of February, there was a full moon with snow on the ground. So that's my Cherokee name.
Okay.
But that's also the Cherokee name for that particular full moon in February.
Okay.
And the other ones are usually associated with different things. The January full moon is usually called the wolf moon. Mm-hmm. After the harvest moon, you have the hunter's moon, also called the blood moon. Because, again, yeah, that's still a good time when the moon is still bright as it rises, good time for hunting the animals. Where they glean the fields, these small creatures will come out, and you can go out and hunt them. Mm-hmm. And there's the sturgeon moon. That's probably, the July moon. That's the Indians up around up lake, and that's mm-hmm. when it was a good time to pick up the sturgeons. Mm-hmm. So they're all associated with something in reality.
Sure.
There's a strawberry moon when the strawberries are ripe.
Mm-hmm.
How about once in a blue moon?
Blue moons. There's actually three definitions of blue moons. The most common now is when you have two full moons in a month.
Okay.
Actually, this December, we will have two full moons. Mm-hmm. But that's actually a mistaken translation of the old farmer's almanac. Occasionally, you'll have 13 full moons in a year, which means somewhere along the line, one month is going to have two full moons. And the farmer's almanac went by seasons, from a winter to spring to summer to fall. And those don't correlate to months strictly. So when you had that extra full moon in a month, you would always have three full moons in a season, and every now and then you would get that fourth one. Then when that happened, the third full moon in a season was called the blue moon.
Okay.
Ah, and, as in once in a...
once in a blue moon. Yeah. Gotcha.
Exactly. And like I say, this one in December, the second full moon is actually after the end of the fall season and starts of the next one, so that one is not a true blue moon.
Okay, but it will be that extra in a month.
It will
least.
Be the two, and that's coming to the common definition of mm-hmm. it now.
Okay,
there's also a visual full moon when the moon actually looks blue. These are really rare,
right.
And they're caused by a lot of smoke or dust in the air. There were some really big forest fires in Canada and Sweden back in 1950.
Mm-hmm.
And for several weeks, the new moon actually had a blue cast to it. And when Krakatoa exploded back in the late 1800s, it mm-hmm. threw a little ton of dust, well, ton, millions of tons of dust mm-hmm. in the air. And there were blue moons for up to 2 years there.
Wow.
It all depends on the very small dust or smoke particles in the air.
Okay.
Do you plant and harvest by the moon? Do you go by your own?
I do a back garden, and I actually plant it by my tomatoes and my crops by the moon.
You'd have to, I guess.
Yes, I have to. I got no choice.
So can you tell if you're a little more successful than your neighbor who doesn't, maybe?
actually, this year I planted my tomatoes right at the crescent between the new moon and the full moon,
mm-hmm.
and they've done absolutely fantastic.
Well, maybe that's the trick, Bob.
I try to get them to die off later in the season. I quit water them, but they just kept on producing.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your book, The 6-Inch Lunar Atlas. What's with that?
That is a book that is mainly photographs and topographical-like maps in it. There are 60 main maps in it, and I've took all these photographs in the last three or four years with a special CCD camera that actually attaches to the telescope. Gives you real high-resolution pictures. I selected 60 best of them and made this atlas.
It's 60 different shots of different places on the moon, is it?
Yeah, each particular 61 is divided into three sections. If you have a telescope, there's three main types of telescopes. A spotting telescope, and you look at the moon, it's right side up as you see it with your eye and binoculars.
Mm-hmm.
There's the Newtonian telescopes, which flip it upside down, your image. And then there's a Schmidt-Cassegrain telescope, which I actually use it right side up. It makes a mirror image out of it. So when you use my book, you don't need to have three separate books. You don't need to turn the telescope upside down. They're all right there for you.
Okay, so each image is represented in those three different ways.
Three times.
And, okay.
And each image is annotated. There's actually about 280 different features identified on it.
Okay.
And then what's your favorite part of the moon and why?
Actually, the very first crater identified on the moon was when the moon was between first quarter and full. And it was the crater Gassendi, which is about 60 miles across, and that has become my favorite ever since. It kind of looks like an old castle with circular walls. It's got three or four little mountains in the middle. It's got a little opening at the bottom with just a little place present, like where a drawbridge should be. Kind of looks like kind of looks like an old castle with a keep right in the middle.
Uh-huh. So Don, does the moon ever really change in your, you know what I mean, in that view that you have of it, and you know you're the different areas and your favorite spot, but are there any nuances about it that actually change?
The sun, when it shines on the moon, is always a little different from one month to the other. So the shadows, certain peaks that you don't see one time will pop out.
Okay.
But as anything actually changes on the moon, I have observed one incident mm-hmm. back in 1984. I belong to a group called the Lunar Transient Phenomena Group.
Uh-huh.
We look for stuff that's happening on the moon. In this case, I got a call from the head of it, who was in Wisconsin. He called me, told me, get out your telescope, go look at the moon. This was at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Devotion.
And look in the Aristarchus region. And he didn't tell me what it was and whatever. And
wanted to see what you thought.
Send me back uh-huh. a report on it. Uh-huh. I got out there, I looked at it, and there was a little pink glow on this crater wall. I have never seen this before and never seen it again. And he reported to the other people throughout the United States. One was in California, one was in Georgia.
They saw the same thing.
And they all, so one of them said it was red, one of them said it was orange.
But
it was
all men are colorblind.
And it was all in the same location. It lasted for about 20 minutes and then just faded away.
What was it?
We don't know for sure. We're guessing that it was kind of outgassing from the cracks in the crater's wall as mm-hmm. they come up. As the sun's shining on the moon, there's no atmosphere, so it's bombarded by ultraviolet radiation.
Okay.
If a low-pressure gas is escaping, it can cause it to fluoresce, and that's what we assume
the
it is.
The best guess, okay.
Now, what about the moon 10, 20 million years from now? Is it ever going to change and leave our orbit for something else?
It is gradually moving away from us at the rate of about 1.5 inches a year.
So it'll be a while.
Wow.
So it'll be a few billion years before it's really out of the Earth's orbit.
But still, that seems sort of significant movement for me, a couple of inches a year further away from us. I mean, that's...
Yeah.
That when you're that big, that...
When you add it up.
Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, well, you know, 100 inches in a year in 100 years, that's only going to be 100 inches.
Yeah. So, okay, the scenario of if we had no moon, it would just be dark at night? And then we wouldn't have tidal?
Tidal
ebb and flow of the tides? I mean, what else would happen?
Well, the tides would still be there. The sun causes very small tides.
Okay, but just
nothing compared to the lunar tides.
Okay.
And with no tides... There and no moon, our calendar as we know it, who knows how it would have evolved to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And most life on Earth is tied to certain phases and certain moons throughout the year. If they mm-hmm. weren't there, would life ever form like that?
Mm-hmm.
That's fascinating.
We don't know. In fact, when I teach my course, I give a special thing on if there was no moon, would we be here? Because, you know, of all the planets, the Earth's moon and the Earth itself are so big together that they're actually a double planet. The center of gravity between two systems is not the center of the Earth, but it's about 1,000 miles below the center of our Earth.
Oh. So. Let's talk a little bit about the class you teach and also the Louisville Astronomical Society, which is coming out to my place October 17th. It's a very active club, so tell us about both.
Okay, the Louisville Astronomical Society has been around since 1933. It's an old organization. It was actually formed by a professor, Dr. Walter Lee Moore, out of U of L then, with a couple other students. And our main purpose for the Astronomic Society is a public outreach. We love to do scouts. We have public observations out at our Urban Astronomy Center, which is out of Tom Sawyer State Park in the old root cellar.
Okay. Right.
And we have telescopes, and we have an observing field right outside there, and... that's where we observe. We set telescopes up out there.
There's one in Indiana, too.
And we have a public, and we have our observatory over in Kirby, Indiana, which is under really dark skies.
Right.
And we do have a public meeting out there once a month. These meetings are usually the Friday closest to a first quarter moon. And you can always pull it up on our website, which is louisville-astro.org, which will give the times of our meetings, if they're a go or a no-go, depending on the weather.
Mm-hmm. Great.
And like I said, it's been around a long time. We're expanding. We have our own regular meetings. To join it is no problem at all. We'd be glad to have anybody. Just go to either look up the Louisville-Astro.org or any search engine will take you to it.
Sure.
Don, thanks for coming in. It's been fun.
Yeah.
Oh, you're welcome. My pleasure. I enjoyed it.
Great. Thank you.
Don Spain is Vice President of the Louisville Astronomical Society and author of the book, The 6-Inch Lunar Atlas. For more information on Don, his book, or the Society, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, we take a short trip to Jefferson Street in downtown Louisville to check out Fresh Start Grower Supply Company. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Hey, Zola.
Yeah, Robbie.
Let's take a stroll.
Where are we going?
Let's check on the moon.
All right.
Sweet.
Shine on. Shine on. Harvest and moon.
Shine on.
Up in the sky.
Shine on.
I had no love since January, February, June or July. Snowtime, ain't no time to stay.
Shine on,
outdoors and spoon.
Shine on,
so shine on. Shine on, hot harvest moon. I rise in my task.
Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishy.
And we are standing in a room full of new ideas here, Miss Wishy.
We are.
Bags of them.
Well, and like some of it, absolutely new ideas in terms of probably the way people are used to gardening.
Yep.
But I like to always think about it as a return to the ways that we used to do things, but then it all got muddled after the war. And we had big equipment and the whole face of agriculture changed and the way we were encouraged to grow and to farm. But yeah, the good news is that more and more places are providing us the materials that we need to grow things organically instead of using conventional products. And we're here in downtown Louisville at Fresh Start Grower Supply. They got their start this spring offering a range of farm and garden supplies, including natural and organic fertilizers, pest controls, livestock feed and supplements, basically anything and everything that you need if you're interested in using natural organic supplies and raising animals, or you know, just having a vegetable garden or an ornamental garden, so you don't even need to be doing it for food or for sustainability. But Steve Paradis is joining us today, has welcomed us to the warehouse. He is the owner here at their location on Jefferson Street of Fresh Start Grower Supply. Steve, thanks for having us down.
Hey, thanks for coming by and checking out our operations.
Sure. First, I got to ask you, I wouldn't qualify you as a farmer by trade, right? So how did you, in fact, get involved in filling a warehouse full of natural and organic farm and garden supplies?
Well, it was real simple. You know, we have a farm out in Oldham County, and we've always tried to be good stewards of the land, and we've got a tree farm out there. But about 3 years ago, I started doing some vegetable growing, and I wanted to try to get some real food into the local school, St. Francis in Goshen. So we started growing our own vegetables, and sooner than later we recognized we didn't have the things we needed to do it right. And that, in this kind of gardening, you've got to have soil supplements, organic amendments, and we were just stuck on where to get those. And so eventually it crossed my mind that we could be a supply house for that, and so that's how we ended up where we are.
So it's sort of a snapshot of the local organic farm economy. Who are your customers? Where do you think you can grow this business?
Well, I think that the most obvious people that are buying from us are the market farmers. When you go to the Saturday morning farmers market at Bardstown Road, or you go to the one up at Beargrass, or I think there's about 28 of them now around the city, those farmers more and more are growing organically and sustainably versus a chemical approach. And so they're a big part of our business. And then the backyard gardeners are turning to this as an alternative, as an option to using more of the chemicals. They know it's safer, they know it's cleaner, and frankly, it grows better food and prettier flowers.
So, Steve, let's break down some of the language that we're using, you know, terms like organic, sustainable, natural, those sorts of things. I mean, I've definitely noticed an increased interest just with the backyard, you know, vegetable grower of getting away from using conventional fertilizers and pesticides. But what does it all mean, you know, in terms of natural versus conventional, and how does it in fact benefit the garden, the growing of the plants, and actually the consumption of the plants, or just the enjoyment of the plants?
Well, that's a good question. I think on a very basic level, the real difference is that the products that we offer work on the soil. It's all about the soil. Will Allen was just in town last week and talking about organic farming and composting and all the benefits therein. And really, when you look at the approach that we subscribe to, we're looking at working on soils and creating great soil fertility and great soil structure. And the synthetic approach are more focused on feeding directly to the plants and bypass the soil. And that gets a good plant for a while, but what you end up with is a very weak soil structure, and then that immune system eventually will translate into a weaker immune system in the plant. So the way I look at it is soil versus plant-based.
And Steve, talk about the transition period required maybe for people who are environmentally concerned more and more, but have been using the old chemicals for years and want to go to what you're talking about. Talk about the testing and how many years it takes maybe to change the soil over to what you want to see it become.
Well, you hit the right word, Bob. First of all, you want to kind of take a baseline, and soil testing is the way to start if you're really serious about changing your soil quality and improving that. So we recommend that people invest in that. There's certainly a number of different soil tests available. The UK Extension Office has soil testing, but we use our own company called ANL, and we like them because they have trace mineral testing as well. But you start there with the soil test, and then from there you can get a good idea of what your soil needs to establish a good balance.
Does it take a couple of years to get the old chemicals out and the organic approach in?
Not necessarily. You know, the biggest challenge, the longest-term problem is when you've got heavy metals in a soil, and that can happen in an urban environment. People can fight that by doing raised bed urban gardens, but generally, if you've got a soil that you're trying to transition, you can do it in a season. It's just a matter of amending it with things like calcium, maybe some green sand to create a more loamy soil, and frankly, you have to insert some biology using compost or something like that.
So let's talk about that biology and the different products that you all have available. And just to sort of set this all up, you carry a line that is from a company called Fertrell.
That's right.
Which is an old company in organic products, right?
That's correct.
Talk about some of the indispensable, I guess, organic products that the home gardener can use to sort of get themselves off of those conventional fertilizers that will impact, as you say, the biology of the soil, not necessarily the chemistry of it all, but the biology of the soil, so it's alive and working together.
Well, I think that's really where the departure starts between synthetic gardening and organic approach. Mm-hmm. And if you look at a teaspoon of healthy soil, you're going to have billions and billions of microorganisms working in that soil that are alive and creating nitrogen and breaking down the soil's minerals for a plant available nutrition. So what you really want to do is start to look at how you're going to insert or create those microbes in your soil. And that's done through very simple methods. Number one, if you've got really healthy compost, that's alive and just robust with microbes. So simply using your own compost or purchasing a healthy organic compost. Now, I recommend vermicompost, and I think that was well spoken about.
Worms.
That's right.
Vermiculture.
The
okay.
Wigglers, yeah.
There you go. Red wigglers. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, it's not rocket science, but it's important that you recognize that the vermicompost or worm compost is kind of the gold standard of compost. It's not you don't have to apply it in bulk, though. You can apply it just very generally across as a topsoil additive, and that'll create the kind of biology you need that'll over time will go down through the topsoil structure.
So if you want to take it one step further than that, what are some of the different products that you offer here at Fresh
Start?
Sure.
One I really like is green sand, and green sand is a silicate. It's a fusion over time with kelp and sand, and that has over 30 trace minerals in it. It works on a three levels. First of all, it adds trace minerals. Secondly, it adds tilth. And thirdly, it is a drought strategy because it actually absorbs up to 10 times its weight. So applying green sand at about 6 to 10 pounds per 1,000 square feet is a great way to do it, and it's not expensive. And what you'll end up with is a loamier soil that is ready for your spring planting. Another one is aragonite. Aragonite is really just mussel shell grounds, and you put those on the garden and work it into your soil, and that provides calcium, but it's also an organic matter. It's alive with biology, and that creates a healthy starter set, if you will, for the microbes to grow and multiply.
Steve, can you ever reach a point where you have a happy, healthy soil that requires almost no continual additives, maybe just less and less as time goes on?
I think so, absolutely. You know, the real, I think, thing we're all trying to reach is not having to put a lot of additives into your soil. And if you've got, you know, just a very good loamy soil that drains well, that has plenty of earthworms in it, you've probably got a soil that is going to be just fine as it is. That the challenge that farmers and gardeners have is when you grow something, let's say you're growing corn, it's going to pull a lot of nitrogen out of your soil. So at the end of the season, it may be somewhat depleted, and you may have to manage that situation. But overall, I think you can reach that, especially if you're taking the organic approach.
Well, and I think it also depends on your farming practices beyond that as well, in terms of machinery and, you know, what kind of crops are being grown and harvested. It's a bigger picture than just as simple as, you know, what we need to add and what
that's right. I think your point about the machinery is a good one. Uh-huh. We switched from using a tiller a few years ago to a spader. Uh-huh. Which it doesn't pulverize the soil as much as a tiller will. And that lifting versus pulverizing has created a lot better soil structures for us. And it doesn't set you back on your, you know, it's like putting your soil in a blender when you use that tiller.
Right.
And when you use a spader, it's just simply lifting and creating an aerobic
situation.
It's like
going to the hairdresser where they, like, you know, fluff your thin hair up sort of thing.
Yeah, you
like
get
our grandmas
you get a fluffing.
You
get a fluffing instead of a Dutch rub.
Absolutely.
I wish.
So let's talk a little bit about the concept of equipment, too. You had mentioned they also have livestock feed, and we were chatting about chickens earlier. Are there goals in terms of expanding what's being offered in terms of different types of equipment? Maybe you had mentioned that you're going to have some portable chicken coops coming in pretty soon too. You know, so as I think Bob sort of alluded to it earlier, I know that you don't want to be, you know, this huge conglomerate business, you know, out just to make money. But where does the opportunity end when
well,
it comes to this,
you know,
this type
a,
of
I guess,
farming?
You know, we're more of a social entrepreneurship, so we're looking at where market meets mission, you know. So I guess what we have to do is continue to listen to what customers are asking for. And when we started this last spring, I had no idea that we would have as many backyard chicken enthusiasts, and that was kind of cool. And we've since learned a lot about, you know, helping people in that area. But I think our next and continuous thing is to continue to ask the customers what they want. One thing I know is that no one in town on the seed side has taken something called the Safe Seed Pledge. The Safe Seed Pledge is interesting because it's for people that refuse to carry GMO seeds, genetically modified seeds. And we recently took that pledge, and our focus is to locate and bring in heritage and open pollinated seeds. And I think that that would be an area that we're going to go to. The other thing is a lot of the people that call in really don't have an understanding of the organic gardening approach, and they need to be educated. And so we're going to start offering workshops here this winter. Our first one will be on backyard chickens in November.
Okay.
So we're starting out in that direction. But it's a continuous evolvement of education. We've got to get the word out and have people understand it's not as difficult as they think. And really, you just start where you are and, you know, take a few little risks and you'll learn just like you do in anything else. So we're excited to be able to provide some of that education in our workshops and, you know, just being in day-to-day consulting on the phone and in person with folks.
And to that end, you've also got products in smaller bags for the smaller backyard gardener as compared to the bigger farmers.
Exactly. We're not just carrying 50-pound bags of green sand, but we've got them in 5-pound bags. We carry blended all-purpose fertilizers. You mentioned earlier, ask about, you know, acid-loving plants. We've got an acid-loving blend called Holly Care, and it's very good. So we carry a host of small consumer-sized bags, and then we're also trying to help set up some dealers around town.
And what would the price comparison be, say, to that, to the regular, the chemical products? I know it's more complicated than that because your stuff is more enduring and lasts. The smaller numbers don't necessarily mean less good stuff in your bags, basically.
Yeah, I think it's really hard. I'm not trying to sidestep the question, but it's kind of comparing apples to pomegranates. It's just it's a whole different approach because right. What we're doing over time is we're lessening the need for our products, which sounds like it's, you know, self-destructive, but I believe that it'll be a long-term need for our products. But over time, instead of needing as much fertilizer or soil amendment, you'll need less and less. And, you know, the first year it may be a little more expensive, 50% more, 30% more. But over time, right. You'll find that you won't need as much and you'll be able to create your own inputs for your garden.
So, Steve, hours of operations, can I come down here and buy a little bag of green manure, as they say? I think I need to get some of your cover crop seed for my vegetable garden for over the winter. You know, can anybody walk in, or is it something where you got to make an appointment?
No appointment necessary. Okay. We can handle you generally 8 to 5, okay. Monday through Thursday. And during the summer, we've had a harvest day on Fridays, but of course, with that coming to an end, we'll be here more often too. So generally 8 to 5 is when we're open, and anybody can come in. Okay. You won't be overwhelmed by the overhead. I can say that.
Yeah.
It's just a warehouse, but you know, that's all right. It's kind of like saving the dollars for the product.
Well, and they can peruse the stock on the website,
FreshStartGrowers.com.
Price lists on there as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. We have a fully functional website with shopping cart capability. You can buy right on the website. And then we also carry commercial prices for professional growers.
Okay. Sounds good. We appreciate your time.
Well, thanks for stopping
Looks
by.
Good.
And we'll get you taken care of with that soil builder mix.
Okay.
All right.
Steve Paradis owns Fresh Start Growers Supply, located on Jefferson Street in downtown Louisville, where you can find a full line of natural and organic farm and garden supplies. And of course, for more information on Steve and Fresh Start Growers, you can go to our website at wfpl.org.
Coming up, a few listener questions and Miss Wishy's new Latin word of the week. You're listening to the Organically Grown Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
Bob Hill with questions.
We do indeed. Here's one for you, Bob. It's from Richard. I have a Japanese maple tree I would like to transplant, but I'm wondering if it's too big. It's about 7 to 8 feet tall, but very narrow and only a trunk diameter of maybe 1 to 1.5 inches. Can it be moved without too much trouble? How big of a root ball would be required? If so, thanks for your help, Richard.
Yes, it can be moved with a little bit of trouble and very carefully. I think one that size is definitely movable. You know, the standard is you want 1 foot of root ball at least for every inch of trunk. I'd want at least a 3-foot root ball, maybe almost 4 feet for this one because it's a Japanese maple. You always get a sharp spade, as Janine suggested. Dig a trench down around the side of the ball, maybe 4 feet across, dig down and under the roots, and then just carefully lift it out and put it in the new hole. But it can be doable. Wait till after the first hard frost, so don't do it now. And just do it quickly and keep it watered. And I've moved a lot of trees that size.
Sure.
It's not that hard to
do. Yeah. And the size seems agreeable.
That's a perfect size to me.
Yeah. All right, Bob, here's one from Phyllis. She's got a couple of concerns about composting. She's new to composting, and what she's done is she's taken a plastic trash can and she's put holes in it, and then she set it up on bricks, mm-hmm. you know, for good air circulation. But she's worried over a couple of things. She's noticing a lot of crawly insect types, as she says. And let's see. She's also worried about a little liquid sort of, you know, dripping
right.
from the compost can. And she's wondering if she can still keep adding stuff to the top, and then maybe if she should cut a hole sort of in the bottom, like a little door, trap door,
yeah.
so she can get the good composted stuff out of the bottom.
Yeah, all those things are pretty much normal. I think the first problem may be using a plastic trash can to begin with holes in the bottom, because it's, a lot of ways it's self-defeating. Without the digging something in the bottom to get the compost mm-hmm. out, you're just going to keep adding, but there's no way to get to it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there are other devices.
So her little trap door would be a good idea.
Yeah, but it'd have to be pretty good size to be able to reach in there.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, if I was a crawly insect, I'd be at the bottom of a compost pit. That's exactly where I'd be. And the liquid is normal. You've got liquid in the green that's coming through there. And yes,
those crawly insect types are helping the whole process, right?
Yeah, they're just eating.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, it's going to decompose. You have to keep adding on the top more and more.
Mm-hmm.
You'd like to be able to turn it over even. Again, that's something else might be hard to do in a plastic trash can. So mm-hmm. she may want to rethink her device, I think.
Yeah, sometimes just a big pile is easier than, you know, putting it in a container because you can turn it a little bit more. But I would just make sure that you balance the brown and green stuff, basically, as you continue to add. And then try your little trap door at the bottom so you can take out little amounts when you need it, all right? But it sounds like everything's moving along and healthy. Don't worry about little creepy
nope.
crawly insects, and don't worry about a little liquid. All of that is completely
normal. It's all God's work here.
That's right.
It's all happening. A question from Bethany for Miss Wishy. Can I just let hostas die back and decompose naturally, or is it important for some reason to cut them off and throw away the foliage? I didn't see any disease problems with them this year. Some of mine are in hard-to-get locations, so do I let them just die back naturally, or?
Absolutely, you can. And, you know, she brings up the one concern. If you've got plants that have disease problems, or if you have other insect infestation types of problems, then it's not a bad idea to clean away garden debris, because you'll clean away places for them to winter over, both the disease pathogens and the insects. But if you feel like you don't really have much of a problem, there's nothing wrong with letting that stuff just sort of die back on its own. Especially stuff like that, because it doesn't leave like a big unsightly mess. It basically gets hit back by the first freeze, and then in a matter of a month or so, it's pretty much gone, and you've improved the soil around
it too.
So, you know, it's all about what you can put up with, I guess, Bob, in the garden in terms of tidiness and all of that. So
it's nature at work.
It is indeed.
If you have a question for Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@wfpl.org or call us at 502-814-8246. Well, Miss Wishy, as is your wont, you've perfectly matched up the subject of the show with the Latin word of the week.
I just couldn't help myself.
You were up all night.
I couldn't help myself.
Doing this,
I was up all night.
Up all night.
Wink, wink.
Up all night she was.
The Latin word of the week this week is noctiflorus, noctiflora, noctiflorum, or nocturnus, nocturnum, nocturna, which means
night flowering.
Night flowering, right.
Betcha.
So there's a handful of plants that I came across that were one or the other. Sistrum nocturnum.
The night flowering jasmine.
Night flowering
jasmine. I would love to sit there and smell that.
Isn't that nice?
Wow.
Epidendrum nocturnum.
The night scented orchid.
The whole like night scented thing, and we've talked about night blooming plants before. Once the temperatures cool, certain plants will give off their fragrance in a little bit more of a powerful way, you know? So it's good to peruse the garden at night, because I think there may be some sensations you can pick up that you've never picked up before.
If I shave late in the day, I'm a night-scented Bob.
Are you?
Yeah.
Oh, great. Ruellia Noctiflora.
Night flowering wild petunia.
Which sounds fabulous. I love that wild petunia. I put it in containers every year out on the patio anyway. Silene noctiflora.
That's silent night, holy night.
Yeah. Silene.
Oh, silene.
Night flowering silene.
I thought it was Christmas.
Night flowering silene. Okay. So obviously the moon has a little bit of pull. It's like what Don said, that gravity can like pull the juices up through a plant. You know, he may be onto something scientific there, and that might be why some flowers prefer to bloom at night.
There's been nights when I got pulled pretty heavily by something.
Oh, we don't want to hear about that. No. Good thing the show's almost over, right? Well, that does end another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, we're going to try to answer some of our summer insect activity questions with Purdue entomologist Tom Turpin.
Homegrown is produced by the always late rising Brad Yost. In the studios of WFPL, I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.